There he is. Wonderful. It's part of it. Okay, so this is called, I think it's pronounced Suidic, Dreaming. I'm written in a doom. Tell me if you can't hear me about this. Last night, I dreamed a dream I'd dreamt before. And indeed, the dream is one of two dreams I've had multiple times over the past several months. The two dreams aren't the same, but they coexist through their performance of an identity that neither possesses alone. So they aren't so much twin dreams as twinning dreams, neither identical nor sprung from the same stuff per se, but nonetheless sustained together as different instances of something shared. It isn't quite right to say that each of these twinning dreams recur, since they're never exactly the same. I've had recurring dreams, and these aren't goals. Instead, these dreams play back into my experience again and again. They recur the way that singing recurs when it's done in a particular register, at a particular tempo, in a particular style, and to a particular ends. They recur generically, which is to say they do and don't recur in the same moment of appearance, only occurring truly in this quasi-recurrence. So the continuities between repetitions are real, they matter, but one still has the sensation of singing anew. In one of the dreams, I'm sitting in a chair, in a room, different from the one we're in now. But I also am not, because I'm observing myself sitting in a chair from the vantage of someone who is above and to the side, as in the corner of the ceiling. It's a vantage that implies that I'm floating, but I have no such airy sensation. It may well be true that a still body is still a body doing, but is an unfelt observing doing still a body, necessarily? I'm seated in a heavy wooden chair, like the ones my school teachers often had, thick with veneer. Not the type with metal legs, stretchers, and rails that we students sat in, but the heavy oak kind with armrests. And looking down and across at myself, there's an old wood-handled shotgun over my knee, balanced by the combined solidity of my and the chair's left arms. The gun is notably large, wide-mouthed really, but seems strangely weightless, although I can't really corroborate this levity because, as with my floating self, I don't have a sense of the sitting me as experiencing anything in a bodily way. There's no scent in the room, neither any sounds, nor any notably textured silence. The sitting me is wearing blue jeans and a nondescript long-sleeve shirt, but the clothes are just kind of there, in a way that a toenail, at least ideally, is. And arguing that all dreaming is fundamentally material and non-abstractable, Henram Banks insists that we must not make concessions to a symptomatic understanding of the relation between dreaming and conscious thought, but should instead focus on the material, microphysical effects of dreaming. And I think that microphysicality is precisely what my dream experience is, but an aggregate of microphysicalities, a sum that's less than its parts, but more so. And I'm looking downwards at myself, my look impassively returned by the sitting me. Looking upwards at myself, my look impassively returned by the floating me. The calmness of my eyes sitting in the chair is most remarkable because of the state of the lower half of my face, which is a mess of flesh, blood, bone, teeth, and hair, hanging precipitously in disarray from the sunken remains of my shattered jaw and cheekbones. So I've fired the gun into my mouth, it's clear, with devastating consequences. And yet, neither of me is particularly upset, because we know in the way of dreams, which I suspect is the truest way of knowing, we know that the decision to pull the trigger and end our lives is somehow one that, while materially enacted, has also not yet been made. Instead, the scene is one of a resonant question, and it's actually a funny question that comes to one of me, and I'm not sure which, but I think it's my floating avatar. It's a funny question that comes to one of me as one that should, by all rights, be blithely posted on Facebook. "Any friends ever been dead?" the post would read. "I've shot myself in the face, and I'm trying to decide if I should undo the action or just go with it and try to live a good death." And despite thinking this would be a worthy post, I don't feel frustrated by the fact that I don't have my computer with me in the dream to write this in the moment, as it were. though I do feel a certain plaintive resignation to the inevitability of losing this jest, given the impossibility of a non-technical memory, that is, dreaming. The absent computer, I suppose, stands for the absent sensation that comes about with a literally doubled embodiment of the dream. At least, that's how one of me interpreted things at the time. The sum of a doubled body is less than its parts, but more so. So looking down at myself in the dream, I have the acute sense of a kind of glossolalia at the level of a decision. That is, the pattern and texture of a decision is given in its meaningfulness, in its eventfulness, but it's given precisely as a disassembly, as disassembled into a causal logic that is at once distributed and reversible, which is to say, not properly causal at all. There are nodes of resolution, of course. If unsensed push came to unfelt shove, I'd probably reside in the floating me, but the choice would feel arbitrary. And likewise, I'm two selves in the dream, but there's always the sense that even this doubled bodily distribution is still something of a concentric conceit, a concentric force that only barely resists the eccentric magnetic pull of the other objects in the room that would have me as them. All of which is to say that the event of the gunshot persistently slides from something experienced as an event to something felt, and by whom it's not clear, but to something felt more like a vibration, a sympathetic resonance of the actants in the room, my two selves, the gun, the chair, and indeed time itself, palpating in and as the networked affordance that might lead to an event. The decision, the eventfulness of my suicide is simultaneously no longer and also not yet taking place, as de Certeau might put it, largely impossible if also operational. In short, what might appear as a decision to shoot myself in the face is more properly the resonant affordances of the scene reinforcing themselves. In this resonant, non-occurring eventfulness, my dream feels similar to what in a 2012 study the psychologist Jennifer Hames called high place phenomena, or HPP. And this is Hames's and her collaborators' term for the apparently quite common urge to, for example, jump off the edge of a proximate cliff, despite not really wanting to kill oneself. And in their study, about a third of the sample said they'd felt the urge to jump from a cliff, or drive into oncoming traffic, or something otherwise similarly suddenly lethal. About a third of the sample said they'd felt such an urge at least once in their life, and while clinically depressed people were more likely to feel this, more than half of those who experienced the phenomenon said they'd otherwise never committed suicide. This HPP is actually a primary vector of the twinning between my two pseudo-recurring dreams. Because in the other dream, the one I haven't described yet, I'm walking down a path next to a railway, when of a sudden myself splits into two, one self floating up into the air and to the right, and the other leaping into the path of an oncoming commuter train. Now, though there's some surprise in the dream, unlike in the first one, as with the one involving a shotgun, there's no real sense of horror. Instead, there's something like a sensitivity to what Stephen Connor calls resonation, a resonating mimetic interlocution between the proximate actors, human and non-human alike. An echolocation of affordances, a locution of inters from which emerges, through the sudden reconfiguration of the field that's articulated by the arrival of the train, a locution of inters from which emerges the human train coupling that is the would-be event of my death. When the results of the HPP study were correlated, Hames and her team of psychologists speculated that the suicidal urge that so many people experience never quite happens as such. Instead, they suggest a scenario wherein a sensitive and anxious person, and HPP does correlate somewhat with anxiety, they suggest a scenario wherein a sensitive and anxious person leans over, say, a ledge, and doing so causes a super-fast instinctual reaction to the physical sensation of anxiety, such that the person's survival instinct forces them to move away from the edge. And then when this person looks at the ledge from which they've just recoiled, they see that it's sturdy, and that as such, there was never any real danger. And so they're met with the question posed by a mind that insists on linearity of why they backed up if the ledge was safe all along. And the suicidal allure is produced post factum as the most plausible, logical answer to that question. In other words, Hames's hypothesis is that people misinterpret an instinctual safety signal and thereby conclude that they must have felt an urge to leap. They leap into the past to produce a cause to the manifest effects of a lived anxiety, its suicide as time travel, a dreamt death that's less than the sum of its parts, but more so. In Hames's view, it's easier to think that we thought something we didn't than it is to think that there might be something unthinkable in play. Or further, presuming that one could have an experience of HPP subsequent to knowing how it works, then further, it's more difficult not to think that we thought something we didn't, more difficult to give ourselves fully to the non-thinking of thought than it is to imagine that the network that connects thought, instinct, consciousness, and action might not actually fully schematize, an imagination that is itself seemingly impossible at the level of instinct. So time is always temporalized in material processes. It always abides by what Manres Khan calls the law of temporal finitude. And in this case, the time of the suicidal allure materializes as the non-coincidence of instinct and thought. The urge to jump is an apocryphal smoothing out of the irregularities through which a decision will have been made. For Hames, this means that the perceived urge to jump, in fact, affirms the urge to live, which is indeed the title of her study. But something like the reverse is also true, then. If Hames's hypothesis holds, the irrationality of instinct, the withdrawal from a danger that was factually not there, the irrationality of instinct suggests an instinctual allure to the self-destructive affordances of a ledge. An instinctual awareness of the way that agencies are couplings of humans and non-humans alike, and that ledges and gravities have instincts of their own to which they attend. This is certainly how I feel in my dreamings, where the untragic non-event of my quasi-death takes hold via the resonant ecology that I dream. And when I roused from this dream for the first time, I did so to the unsettling sensation of mud oozing from my ears. And as I lay awake that morning, prostrate on my belly with my eyes closed, I listened to and through an oozing texture to a weird and dolorous melody meandering in the background, indelibly mixing the productive and receptive vectors of my hearing. The muddy relationality precedes the component parts it purportedly causes, in that the relations are produced in their particularity as much as they are uncovered as components of a listening system. It's a reverse causality that Hames would undoubtedly psychologize. It's also a sum that's less than its parts, but more so. So lying still in bed, I listened carefully that morning, alarmed by the mud, but respectful of what is given to waking consciousness immediately following a dream well dreamt. I heard my muddy listening as occurring in a space that was already full, a space brimming over like an incoming tide, not just obscuring the shoreline, but in fact redrawing it, intensively and extensively, within and beyond myself. I listened to and through a mud that intercepted my own hearing process and attuned me to the work of my own ears. Groggy and anxious, I listened auto-interceptively, my ears an informational black box, because I knew what was going in, I knew what was coming out, but I didn't know precisely what was happening in the middle. And indeed, since it was auto-interceptive, things were in fact even a step more complex. I knew there were transformative comings and goings, but I didn't know the directions. Excuse me. I knew there were transformative comings and goings, but I didn't know the direction of the transformations, nor specifically what they entailed. I did know, and I do know now, that my mucilage-inflected hearing attested to sonic systematicities that are produced by the relationality of a beyond-human sound world that defies being diagrammed according to its signals, senders, and receivers. The mud was at once the source of my partial deafness and an amplifier of the sounds of my listening. Listening is always muddy, but sometimes you have to get your ears dirty to tune into just what this means. Or so the echo of my Swedic dream told me that morning. And indeed, these otoacoustic emissions, these sounds produced by my hearing that interacted with the heard acoustic world, but which were not of either, these otoacoustic emissions attuned me to what might be called a primary relationality of listening in general. Sound particularizes in individual bodies, such that it occupies the abstract space through which those bodies relate, which is to say the intervals, tempos, intensities, amplitudes, contours, and boundaries through which they become bodies in the first place. A sound makes no demands except to be heard, such that my muddy black box is not just a problem for communication, but in fact is the problematic form of communication itself. The form through which an informatic paradigm, wherein relations are mere connections, indifferent to their content, qualitatively equivalent. The form where this informatic paradigm is denaturalized. And from this denaturalization, it becomes clear, indeed it becomes clear as mud, it becomes clear that to listen is to attend to the effects of a reality the cause of which can never be singly determined, even as a coming together of more than one. So the proverbial sound of one hand clapping isn't the limit case of sound, but rather its basic enabling condition, providing that we accept that every singular hand is itself a multiplicity. A sound is less than the sum of its parts, but more so. Last night I dreamed a dream I dreamt before, as I said. And indeed, the dream is one of two dreams I've had multiple times over the past several months, as I said. In my dream, the sitting me's face records the event of its own annihilation. And my twin selves, looping one another's lookings, together play the not yet occurrence of the event back into their relation, again and again, until the resonant frequencies of the relation reinforce themselves. Any semblance of the event, with perhaps the exception of my facial structure, is distributed beyond recognition. And it's exactly like the radio, except without the wiener dog. Thanks.